obvious reason. It is not something that just happens. Illumination nearly always ties into a pattern of immediate need. Illumination seems to indicate that under the necessity of a situation, the trained, unfolded, dedicated, consecrated consciousness breaks through because it has been called upon. It has been called forth into action. Now, however, this does not necessarily mean that it responds to a cry of desperation from the ego. Illumination nearly always occurs in the presence of a need carried in suspension. And this, I mean something like this, perhaps. Supposing in an emergency, the individual says, I've just got to find a solution. I've just got to find a solution. Well, he'll say that from now on because he has blocked himself completely by his own attitude. But if this person is devout in his religious life, and in the presence of a great emergency or a great challenge, he sits down and asks the guidance of heaven, very quietly to himself in the presence of this emergency, as the old American Indian medicine priest used to say, Father, show me the way. Show me the way. In other words, not to help me to do it my way, or I want it done this way, or this is the only solution I'll accept, but rather, not my will, but thine be done. A relaxation into the divine will, in which we stand ready to serve that revelation, whether it be according or not according to our own desire. In other words, we are not any longer seeking a solution conditioned to our own appetites. We are asking very simply for the solution. And if this solution seems to work a hardship upon ourselves, we will still accept it and will fulfill it because we are no longer concerned with hardship or lack of hardship. We are concerned with truth, with the fact, with the reality as it is. Under those conditions, if we can allow this solution to be the working of the law in this matter and accept it without question, it is then quite possible that in our relaxation, the light that we need will come. In fact, it nearly always comes. For there's nothing that can block it except our own lack of adequate adjustment with the principle involved. And the principle involved in all of these situations is not our will be done, but let the law be perfectly manifested in this work. If we then find that the law kicks us right out of the work, that is the perfect working of the law, and we accept. But usually, if we have this attitude and have gone this far, we shall find that the law is not far from the thing which we most devoutly believe to be necessary. So it is this problem of always aligning the illumination with the solution of a real or present need. This need is not an obsession, but it is a natural requirement. And that which is naturally required, nature will produce. Thus, nature provides us with what we have earned. But our struggle is to try to get nature to give us something we haven't earned. And if we insist in this process long enough, nature will oblige us by giving us something that isn't so. Because nature will not permit that which is true to be conveyed to that which is not able or willing to use truth as it was intended to be used. So illumination always takes form of this certain something that is added. It is this next and immediate need. And we can simply say, as the old country physician that I knew years ago, he was not one of the great school of medicine. He was just a good old country doctor. And he explained to me how he handled sickness. He said he knew about 50 different pills he could give people. He knew about 4 or 5 different major surgeries that he could perform on the kitchen table if necessary. He knew 12 or 20 forms of minor surgery. He knew all kinds of simple remedies, such as putting your feet in hot water and your head in cold water, whatever the need was at the moment. But he said, when I get to the circumference of this, I'm through. The only thing I can do then is turn it back to God. So he said, when I cannot find a remedy in my book, he says, I just sit down and I say, God, if you want me to help this fellow to get well, you'll have to tell me how. And he said, usually I got the answer. And I got it sometimes in most remarkable ways. So there is this very simple approach to the same thing. And this old doctor getting a hunch out of thin air when he needed it most was quite convinced of the reality of divine intercession. And it worked. And because it worked over a long lifetime, his faith was strong and clear. So the same thing can happen to each of us. Illumination, therefore, is this something that comes when something is needed. And the more unselfish and real the need, the more certain the light is to come. And by degrees, this process of the light coming through grows or enlarges as we improve and enlarge. Until finally, one of these greater experiences that we hear about and read about may come to us. Actually, the true mystic is not too much concerned. The person who is waiting from day to day for illumination is in a bad way. This is not the method by which it can be done. The method is very simple. Live the life and you will know the doctrine. Do the thing that needs doing every day, and the life and light that you need unfolds in you and through you as it becomes necessary. That brings us to another paragraph here, which I wanted to mention also. Illumination can never come until the causes for it have been definitely established. Do not wait for it. Do not hope for it. Do not wonder about it. Do not fear that it will not come. Develop realization, normalize, and beautify life. And illumination will be the normal and natural consequence, not of a single episode, not one tremendous burst of enlightenment, but a steady, released, and increasing flow of understanding into and through the lower faculties of the reason. Now this brings us another point which I'd like to enlarge on, and that's this problem of the faculties of the reason. Because we pass them off rather quickly here with little more than a few sentences. And I think there is more need for this matter. The processes of our faculties, as we have mentioned many times before, are two-way bridges by which impulse is carried in from the outer world and out from the inner life. These two processes are constantly functioning. Now, if the torrent or pressure of the inflow of externals is greater than the corresponding pressure of the outpouring of internals, then the internal elements are not released. The torrent is too strong, and the inner faculties are not able to come through because of this tremendous pressure of externals. Consequently, the inner faculties, which are not of themselves competitive, It's an interesting thing, I think, to realize that the consciousness of man is not dogmatic or dominating. In fact, it is so retiring by its very constitution that most people never locate it. It seldom has anything much to say. It never points out to anyone its own importance. It never reminds us that it is the master. It leaves us to discover these things for ourselves. Many people have felt that deity was a little negligent because it allowed so many misfortunes to occur in this world. And we all feel at some time or other that we could certainly have done a better job of it. But actually, the entire mystery of truth is non-dogmatic. We use the word as though it had the whole weight of dogma behind it. But actually it is not. Truth comes as a small, still voice. Truth comes in extreme quietude, and illumination, and all the things that have to do with this unfoldment may be regarded as an exceedingly gentle, passive fact. The inner life never really tries to force its way out. It can only be released when the conscious purpose of the individual is enlisted. The outside will flow in by accident, but the inside will only flow out by intent. It will never flow out by accident. The outside flows in with tremendous pressure upon us because the inner life of the individual is essentially negative. It is a sort of a vast area which accepts into itself almost any form of miscellaneous phenomena. On the other hand, if the internal life polarizes itself, then it becomes more positive than the phenomenal world. Yet this positiveness is not an aggressive, dominating, or dictatorial positiveness. It is simply an establishment of values. It becomes too real for anything else to interfere with. So in our search for inner understanding, we have to find various ways of reducing the pressures that moving upon the surface of the personality obscure its depths. And we have to reduce the impact of phenomena, because this impact causes us so much tension and attention that we are unable to make adequate use of our intuitive faculty. We are world-bound. There are so many things happening around us that we are no longer able to be sensitive to the things that are happening within us. Thus we develop bad habits. Thus also we fall into various common errors of our day, simply because we do not have strength enough to remain aware of inward value under the pressure of outward circumstance. So again, we have this problem of the victory of internals over externals. The individual achieves this victory by realization and relaxation. Relaxation is not just letting the body sit somewhere. Relaxation is releasing the tension of faculties. Relaxation means that the objective sensory perceptions are no longer devoutly dedicated toward object. The eye is not trying to see everything it can. The ear is not trying to hear everything it can, or being bombarded by sounds it does not even want to hear. As Buddha points out, as we relax internally, we remove energy from the circumference faculty. In other words, there is no longer so much vital energy to stimulate sight, hearing, taste, touch, smell. These faculties are reduced in intensity because we have withdrawn energy from them. When they are so reduced in their own intensities, they do not bombard the central mental coordinator with all this wild confusion of symbolic phenomena. Because this bombardment slows down, order is reestablished within the self. Reflexes are brought to the condition that they can be handled. The individual is not seeing so much that he cannot consider any part of it. Reducing by degree this tremendous surging wave of phenomena beating against him, the individual thus begins to release internal life. He discovers that far more important than phenomena will be the testimony of the noumenal part, the internal life. As the outer quiets, the inner can be known. The outer shouts, the inner seldom speaks above a whisper. Therefore, the sound and the fury destroy the power of the inner to be heard. There's an old Chinese fable that tells about a little bird, very tiny little bird, with a very tiny but very beautiful little note that was sitting on the side of an old tree. And the sage came along, and there was a great storm. And the storm was so tremendous. The thunders rolled, and the winds blew. The trees were shaken. And the roar of the storm was so much that you could not hear the note of the tiny little bird. So the old holy man sat down because he loved to hear birds sing. And he went into meditation. He was very quiet. One by one, he closed out the roaring of the storm, the sound of the winds, and all of these things, and focused his consciousness entirely upon the song of the bird. And in a very few seconds, he could hear that little song perfectly. And there wasn't a sound from the storm. He couldn't hear that at all because he tuned it out. Now, to a measure, the storm is life and the little bird is the human soul. And if we are able to shut out through our realization discipline the false sound, we can hear the voice of the beautiful singer, like the singing Lohans so greatly honored in China. So that the voice of the infinite is always represented as a very gentle, quiet voice that can only be heard when all other sound is stilled. And realization, meditation, contemplation, concentration, these have as their ultimate end that we shall be able to achieve the divine silence within ourselves, by which we shall be aware of the internal directive which come to us so faintly, so softly, that we can hardly note them. We have always thought of a God of fury, a God of battles, and a God thundering his commandments from the top of the flaming mountain. But we experience this power, not in this way at all. We experience it as a very gentle, subtle thing that can be heard only when that is the only thing we want to hear. When we are willing to listen to anything else, we will not hear the voice of truth. Now, here's another little point that I think is important. We discussed at some length here the problem of Taoism. The second Taoist doctrine concerning illumination emphasizes the necessity for sufficiency. The doctrine creates itself, sustains itself, abides by itself, moves impelled by its own nature, and has no home but space. Now, this is a way in which the Taoist uses the symbol of the dragon, the to represent the nature of the completely sufficient doctrine. In other words, the Taoist points out that the inner life of man achieves a kind of sufficiency, which as the illumination and as the enlightenment spreads, this sufficiency becomes so total that the person becomes a space dweller, like the dragon. Now, the dragon never puts its foot upon the earth. The dragon must never be seen, all of its body at one time, because if it is, it will destroy whoever sees it. Therefore, in art, the dragon is always partly enveloped in clouds, so that all of its body may not be seen at the same time. The dragon lives upon space. It lives in space. It nests in the sky without any... And the fact that it had to be partly concealed by clouds was that the human being cannot as yet surpass the full doctrine. He can only perceive certain parts of it. Otherwise, he is shattered beyond survival. But in this sense of sufficiency, I think we have a point that we'd like to make. Well, this attacks the fundamental human impulse toward dependency. Even religion subtly inculcates a doctrine of dependency. Man is ever searching for a strength outside of himself upon which he can cast his burden. Thus, with our meditation and our discipline and our search for realities, there must come this sense of sufficiency without fear, and also without arrogance. The individual must finally realize that his existence is complete in the term of self and space. Any dependency must lead to compromise, or to a false sense of dependence upon that which is apart from the truth. So man, leaning in one direction and leaning in another, is searching forever for something to sustain or support him. But he only needs the support because he himself is off balance. Thus, equilibrium is self-sustaining. And this type of internal equilibrium is very important to man. As he proceeds in his studies and in his experiences, he must finally choose between a certain sense of weakness and a greater sense of strength. The person who is inwardly unfolding loses by degrees the need for dependence. It loses the need for the dependence upon the opinions of others. He finally loses the sense of need for dependence upon belief, or upon faith, or upon any of these things. All of this dependence is necessary only while the dependent person is internally unillumined. But the full expression of enlightenment gives the insight that the person is forever sufficient to his need. The Taoists also use again, in this particular symbolism, the idea of the bird, because the bird has always been a thing of such beauty in the experience of man that it is easy for him to fall into mystical poetry or mystical thoughts about it. What could be more helpless from the standpoint of man's concept of things than the little bird that builds its nest under the eave of our house? This bird and perhaps its mate are totally isolated as far as associations are concerned. We have no evidence whatever that they have any life apart from themselves. We cannot imagine that they have adequate insurance against difficulties. that they have any one to cry to in the night when pain comes. They cannot send for a physician. They cannot engage a lawyer. They have no architect or builder to construct their house. They have no one to deliver food. They have no one to provide anything. And these two little furry and feathered creatures are alone in space. Alone in a little nest of broken twigs, perhaps a few feathers and bits of cloth and hair, which they have gathered. This is their world. This is their home. They do not know when someone will come along and tear it down. They do not know whether the neighborhood cat will invade it. Yet here, completely alone, with nothing beyond themselves, not even parent, and later not even child, these little creatures are apparently completely free of any sense of loneliness. They do not know they are alone. The little bird does not know that he is alone. The wise man has forgotten that he is alone. This difference is very tremendous. The little bird also, when it builds its nest and bears its young, fulfills the mystery of life without knowing why. It continues its little way. And in nature, very few things die a natural death, unless we consider that it is natural that they be prey for something else. But in that span of time, the song, the labor, the building, the nest, the eggs go on as long as life is given to them. There never seems to be any sign of serious neurosis. There are no frustrations and no inhibitions. There are no theologians to preach to them. Perhaps this is a blessed preservation. They have never been taught to be afraid, because they live in a very world of nature. The light and the rain, the sun and the moon and the stars form their world, and they seemingly never have inquired about any of them. They have their own small purpose, and they fill it completely out of themselves. The Taoist points out, therefore, that life, even in a little insect, is totally sufficient to its own needs. It is only in man, with his reflection, his contemplation, his doubts, and his worries, that life suddenly becomes more or less impossible. Actually, this problem of dependence is an illusion. It doesn't mean that we, as human beings, should not have relationships. We have much richer ability to know and to share and to do, and can possibly belong to the little bird. Yet in our life, it is not that we should be less than the bird in this, but rather that we should be greater than the bird in everything. And that means also greater in security, greater in the security of our own inner life. We have infinitely more ways of protecting ourselves than the bird, yet we are much less secure, because we do not have this direct participation in nature. We do not have this wonderful sense of not knowing that there is anything to be afraid of. In realization, we get something of that, but on a positive level. We gain this mysterious sense that factually and actually we are always alone, and yet we are never. Every important function of life, birth, death, great sickness, even great joy, will be experienced alone. Somehow, everything that is important, we have to carry the full burden ourselves. This is not a penalty. This is a fulfillment. This is a privilege. This is the reason we are here. The life we share with other people is not a life of necessity unless we make it that. It is a life of privilege and of opportunity. We should not be with other people because we want to lean on them or because we are afraid to stand on our own feet or because we feel like some old Chinese communities that the closer we are together, the safer we are. This should not be the basis of relationship. The basis of relationship should be a voluntary sharing, not a dependence. And this difference is part of our realization problem. For in realization, we can achieve this wonderful sense of security in space. That there is nothing evil. There is nothing dangerous. There is nothing to fear but truly fear itself. And as we quietly contemplate this and relax, we again lower pressure. We lower tension. And our spiritual life begins as our tensions go down. There can be no way of achieving an adequate spirituality in a constant confusion, discord, tension, and stress. Now, we may feel that this stress is due to other people or other circumstances and that we cannot help it. This is simply not true. The stress may be caused by another person. But our acceptance of it as stress is our own private business. And there is no reason why we have to be over-influenced any more than we have any right to over-influence anyone else. We have a perfect right to live in a stressful world with the same gentle sense of interior security that we find in the little birds. And today, perhaps, in this world in which we live, with all the tensions and the pressures we have created, the most fortunate of all creatures are those that are not human. But belonging to other ways of life, are still able to go about in their numerous activities without very much concern over our political situation. This is perhaps a proof that nature protects the innocent. They are not to blame, therefore they are not punished. We are only punished if we are to blame. And this blame arises as an experience in our own consciousness, not in the circumstances that arise. Now there is another very interesting thing that I'd like to amplify just a little bit in our book, and that is quite near the end, where we make a story or a little analogy about the human mind, which I think can take further thought. The more I read it, the better I liked it, so I'll share it with you again. It's about the great Nordic god Thor, the mighty thunderer, the individual who rumbles his great hammer and rides through the heavens in his wooden chariot drawn by rams. He's quite a character in his own right. The charming allegory is the story of the difference between the personality and its principle. Thor of the mighty hammer, the destroyer of giants, is the human mind, the objective intellect. The mind is the conqueror of the mundane world and was the most powerful and the most belligerent, and in another way, the most depended upon of all the gods. But although he was a deity in his own right, the gods all got together and made a rule. He was so heavy, so massive, so big, and in a sense, so excitable, that they would not let him enter heaven by the front door. He had to go around the back. Because the front door was a bridge of rainbow that connected heaven and earth. And it was figured that that bridge would never carry the weight of the great Thor and his hammer. so he always had to climb up the back of the mountain by the slow and difficult path. Now, this, I think, is a very interesting analogy on the basis of the human mind. In a sense, this magic bridge, Bifrost, that connects heaven and earth, is a bridge of intuition, a bridge of extrasensory perception, a bridge of very delicate, subtle, internal lights and colors that form a wonderful rainbow of inner inspirational value. And it would certainly be rather difficult to imagine great lumbering Thor trying to climb up this bridge. It would be as though we placed a very aggressive intellectual in the presence of a very mystical person and expected the intellectual to understand. The mind, which is by nature a battler, a great and massive instrument, valuable, but with limitations, has difficulty when it confronts an intuitional problem. And reason, when confronted with this mystical, apperceptive power of man, is not trusted to climb that bridge, for fear will break it down. And reason is forever breaking down these subtle values. And reason is using its own intellective power in some mysterious way to weaken the element of creative intuition, imagination in man. So always in our meditations and in our mysticisms, we must remember that the mind, with its faculties, very useful, a great and strong giant who can also go out and destroy other giants. This mind, however, is a constant and continuing danger when it comes to the intuitive life of the individual. Thus, our illumination and our realization must, to a measure, reduce the intensities of the mental attitude toward life. Most of all, they must prevent us from substituting mentalism for mysticism. And there is a tremendous difference in these two things. The mind can accomplish almost any part of philosophy. It can master nearly any element of theology. The mind can read, remember, analyze, and digest the most abstract, mystical, and extraphysical conditions. The mind can explore anything. But of itself, it cannot experience what it explores. Thus, the mind is always the beholder and the observer. It is never the participator. The mind cannot share in the sheer mystery of life itself. It can write a book on what it cannot experience. It can carefully analyze and dissect all things relating to the universal plan, but it cannot experience these things. Thus, out of the mind come sciences. Out of the emotions come art. Arts come much nearer to experiences than sciences do, because man's emotion is an older and richer instrument than his mind. But the mind itself can substitute a vicarious intellection for a fact. The individual can honestly believe that if he has remembered, he knows. That if he can call off great names, he is instructed. If he can quote from the sages, he is wise. And if he has achieved by his own genius the quadrature of the circle, he is illumined. These things he can believe. But we come back to the Indian proverb that the mind is the slayer of the real. Therefore, in all of our searches for realization and illumination, we must never be deceived by the mental substitute. We must never permit ourselves to assume that intellection is the substitute for the mystical internal experience of the individual. Nor can the individual become so wise in his mentation that he does not need the direct experience of value. Well, in our discussions of realization and illumination, we must point out that these are not intellectualized in truth or in reality, any more than the mysterious security of the small bird is intellectualized. It is not. It is there. It is fact. It is not thought. Now, the difference between a thought and a fact is a very important one. And thoughts may help us with facts, and facts may lead to thoughts, but the two are not identical terms. Therefore, if we have an extension of understanding and a reformation of conduct through inner enlightenment, we may then think for many years about the implications of this, and stirred and spurred by inner enlightenment, the mind then becomes the instrument of recollection and also enables us to take a particular experience and expand it or extend it over a larger area of circumstances. The mind can take the key achieved by illumination and place it in many locks, giving us broader insight than we had previously possessed. But the mind, unless it is moved by and in service to the consciousness itself, can be, and usually is, merely an intellectual tyrant. So the mental phase of an experience should never be accepted as that experience. An over-intellection about an experience before it occurs is likely to block the experience itself. This, I think, is well worthy of our bearing in mind, because we have to face it more or less continuously as we proceed. Also, we have one other point. We are approaching this entire matter from below upward. In other words, we have a perspective. The perspective from that which is in a certain condition, toward a condition in advance of that now experience. This makes a perspective in an upward direction. And as we mentioned in one of our Sunday lectures recently, we have these psychological directions in space. If the direction, therefore, of the experience is forward and up, it also comes naturally to us that as we proceed along the way, each step of enlightenment will modify and change our basic attitude toward what we are doing. From where we are now, we are doing what we think is next and best. But when we have achieved to a higher degree of understanding, we may be forced to change or modify our principles of the moment, or our directions at the moment, or the directives by which we move. Nearly all persons writing books of a prophetic nature as to how the world is going to be 1,000 years from now have forgotten some phase of this dimension. Therefore, they have simply pushed now into tomorrow, which you cannot do. Or they have taken certain faults of now and assumed that tomorrow they would be corrected. This was the burden of the old utopias, which were certainly idealistic in their time, but seem a little ridiculous to us today. Therefore, in moving forward, our whole attitude toward truth, our attitude toward self, toward enlightenment, towards understanding, realization, toward illumination, these attitudes will change. They will never be less than they are, but they will be greater than they are, for they will be more and more tinged with insight. And in all probability, this will have a very grave effect upon the motivations with which we now move, we will find that our present motive will be outgrown along with our present mistakes. And that, as one old and very wise mystic said, when man reaches near to illumination, as indicated in the last page, where I quote an old Sufi in this manner, as we approach illumination, the very fact of illumination becomes less interesting. At our present state, it's something so infinitely to be desired that we are gravely concerned. But as we get nearer and nearer to us, to this end, it becomes so inevitable, so natural, so completely reasonable and proper that we no longer regard it with any particular significance. It is then that we realize something else that we can learn from the little bird, namely that illumination is not a strange, distant, unnatural, wonderful state. It only seems to be. Illumination is simply, as we said in the beginning, a tree bearing its fruit. Perfectly natural, perfectly reasonable, perfectly proper, and utterly inevitable. We therefore view it as we would view any other of the commonplaces of life. We would regard it as with the same feeling that we would say our child will grow up. In 7 years, it will be mature. In 10 years, it should be established in business and home. We think of these things as natural and probable procedures. In our materialistic age, bound with the uncertainties that now circumscribe us, all spiritual things seem highly improbable. But as we grow and unfold and enrich our consciousness, all spiritual things become not only probable, but natural, inevitable, factual. And the person, as he approaches the insight which he seeks, finds that this insight is not a tremendous or terrible experience. This insight is simply fulfillment of that which was obviously necessary and obviously there. So enlightenment presents no great challenge. It presents only the symbol of our spiritual maturity. It represents the condition of the person who has come into the full possession of those powers and faculties by which he was divinely endowed. Therefore, perhaps we may say that when man achieves enlightenment, then he is a human being. Until then, sometimes we hardly know what to call him. But we are not quite certain that he is a success. This illumination problem, then, is our maturity. And if we can face it in a simple way like this, we will get away from the exaggerations that may lead us into illusion. Always to make things overly important is dangerous, because it creates tension and self-deceit. Whereas if we simply say, the growth from today, the right living now, the daily and honorable experience of proper self-improvement, dedication to principles and to truth, the gradual unfoldment and enrichment of life and faculty, these things are all moving us toward ourselves, toward the thing we were intended to be, toward the nature which we must be, for our universal nature has decreed it. Therefore, as nature makes the grass to grow, so it makes the soul of man to grow. And our illumination is simply man coming into the conscious participation in God. Awareness made rich, so that he now lives in a universe with God and in God. He has always lived there, but he didn't know it. Therefore, illumination is man coming to know the thing as it is. While ignorance is his continuance in the state of not knowing, or the misknowing of things. Really, these things can be taken into our realization. They can be taken into our quiet meditation. And if we use these basic principles and precepts wisely and kindly, we will grow. And the problems which beset us will go less with time as it passes. And with the diminishing of problems will come the corresponding increase of insight. Well, our time is up, so I guess that's all we can do this evening.